now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Brenda Phillips. Today I'll be reading from the book The Faithless Dollybird by Joan Aitken. Far away to the north, in a small hut in the middle of a large forest, there lived a weaver whose name was Luke. All this happened not long ago as the clock ticks, but a long way off as the crow flies. In his hut, Luke had a loom taking up most of the floor space, and every day on his loom he wove the most beautiful cloth, material for coats and cloaks and carpets, for sheets and shirts and shawls, for towels and tablecloths and tapestries, for babies' blankets and bishops' aprons. Some of the things he made seemed almost too good for everyday wear and tear. They were so beautiful that it seemed wrong to do anything but hang them on the wall and gaze at them. But everything he made was really meant to be used. And to help him with his weaving, Luke had a bird, a lolly bird. When he had strung up his loom ready to start, with the woolen or cotton or silk threads going longwise, the warp, Luke would tie another length of wool to a shuttle and hand it to the lolly bird, which up to that moment would have been sitting quite still on the chimney piece or a corner of the loom or Luke's shoulder, carefully watching all that he did without moving a single feather. However, as soon as he handed the shuttle to it, this lolly bird would begin to fly with the most amazing speed back and forth, in and out, up and down, among the strings on the loom, going so fast that nothing of it could be seen at all except a blur of colour as it shot to and fro. The lolly bird itself was just a little grey creature, but as it worked it would snatch one thread and then another from Luke. Sometimes dropping the shuttle entirely, it would wind a scarlet strand round its neck, and a green one round its stomach. It would carry a pink thread in its beak and clutch a silver one in its claws, so that if it ever stopped, if you could have caught a glimpse of it, you would have thought it was a travelling Christmas tree, all sparkling and rainbow-coloured. But it never did stop work until it was finished and the last knot was made, the last thread pulled tightly into place. Then, with a final swoop and a last flash of its wings, it would come to rest on Luke's shoulder or the top of his head, and together they would take a careful look at the piece of cloth they had just woven. Perhaps it was a coronation robe for a king, all scarlet and gold, with fur around the border and a roaring lion in the middle. Or perhaps it was a carpet for a cathedral, with angels and lilies and harps all in blue and green and silver. Or maybe it was a curtain for some great gallery in the Lord Mayor's house, with a picture of unicorns roaming through the forest and butterflies fluttering among the apples on the branches. Or it might be a tablecloth for a children's school with cats and dogs and the sun and moon and birds and fish and letters and numbers to give children something to look at as they were eating their dinner. Whatever the piece of cloth was they had just woven, Luke and his lolly bird would carefully inspect it, making sure there were no rough edges or lumpy places or loose threads anywhere. But there never were. Then Luke would give a sigh of satisfaction and say, "Well, I think we did a good bit of work that time, my dear lolly bird." The lolly bird would cock his head on one side in approval and say, "Certainly can't see anything wrong with that little job, master." And the two friends would stop work for a short time. Sometimes, in these spells off between jobs, Luke might play his flute while the lolly bird chirped a little song. The lolly bird had no voice to speak of, and its song sounded like someone scratching a twig down the side of a nutmeg grater. Indeed, the lolly bird was a little embarrassed about his lack of singing ability, but Luke didn't mind. He had a mandolin as well as a flute, and sometimes the lolly bird, hopping to and fro on the mandolin strings, would scratch them with its claws and fetch out a faint thread of a tune, while Luke softly whistled a few matching notes. Then, if the day was a fine one, they would go for a walk in the forest, the lolly bird sitting on Luke's shoulder or flying ahead of him among the great trunks of the trees. On these walks they searched for leaves and flowers and roots that Luke needed to dye the silk and wool he used in his weaving. There was a plant with golden flowers, whose root gave a beautiful yellow, and a purple flower that dyed red, and a kind of toadstool, which, pounded to a pulp, produced a fine dark orange, and the bark of a tree which could be ground up to make a deep rose pink. Wild spinach gave them bright green, and certain nuts and berries were good for browns and crimsons. The only colour they couldn't get from any plant in the forest was a blue to satisfy them. For that, Luke had to send away many hundreds of miles. A kind of shellfish found only in southern seas gave a beautiful clear dark blue. But Luke often grumbled because the loads of shellfish, which often had to be brought through the forest by sledge, took a long time on the way. And sometimes, if a pattern they were working on used a lot of blue, they might have to wait for a new supply to arrive. "I wish we could find a decent blue close at hand," Luke would say. On their walks through the wood, the two friends also found tufts of coloured moss and flower petals, bright leaves, flakes of glossy bark, grey feathers dropped by birds, even small sparkling stones and chips of rock, which they wove into their fabrics, so that often the lengths of material they made were quite dazzling and seemed to shine and ripple the way a brook does when it catches the sun's light. Because the things he made were so beautiful, Luke's fame began to spread all over the world. More and more people wanted to buy his work. Customers came from farther and farther away, in ships, on camels, by sledge and bicycle and caravan, in lorries and balloons, on horseback and in helicopters, so that presently, after a few years had passed, Luke and his lollybird had to work harder and harder if they were to keep up with all the orders that poured in. "I never get the chance to sit in the sun any more," complained the lollybird. "We haven't had time for any music since the last new moon. We don't even get a breath of fresh air." Recently, Luke had hired two boys to hunt for his dye plants and mosses. The ones they brought back were not always so good, but there was no time for Luke and his lollybird to go into the forest. They had to work all the hours of daylight. By the time night came, the lollybird was tired out and would fall asleep perched on the loom with its head tucked under its wing. "You should refuse to take any more orders," it said to Luke one morning. "It would be wrong to disappoint people," said Luke, "especially when they've come all this way. Why, only today we had the Emperor of Japan wanting a new dressing gown, and the Mayor of New York needing a carpet for his city hall, and the Queen of the Windward Islands with an order for a screen to ward off the wind, and the manager of Milan Opera about a new stage curtain for his opera house, and the President of Finland ordering a new tapestry for the finish." "Finish? We shall never finish," wailed the lollybird, and it snatched up a shuttle and darted angrily between the warp strings of a beautiful white and silver christening shawl that they were making for a little princess in Denmark. "She wouldn't know the difference if they wrapped her in an old bath towel," it muttered as it flew back and forth. "It would be wrong to disappoint the people," repeated Luke. "What about me? I'm disappointed if I don't have a bit of music or get out for my evening stroll," said the indignant lollybird. Matters became worse, for now a railway was built through the forest, with a station right beside Luke's hut, so that more and more people could come to order things and watch the weavers at work. The visitors stood around and picked up the shuttles and the tangled wool, and were a dreadful nuisance all day long. In the evening they invited Luke out to a cafe that had been built just down the road, and they talked to him and praised his work, and asked him how he planned his patterns. He quite enjoyed all the company and cheerfulness. It made a change from the long, quiet evenings he had spent alone with the lollybird after it grew too dark to go on the weaving. When he had had nothing to do but play his flute, not very well, while the lollybird sang its little scratchy song, like a pencil being scraped down a nutmeg grater. The lollybird didn't enjoy all this extra company at all. It never took part in the conversation or went to the cafe. As soon as the light was gone, it would retire to the back of the loom and go to sleep there, hidden among dangling hanks of wool, with its head under its wing. And even during the day, when the lollybird was working, very few people noticed it flashing to and fro under the strands of the warp, for it went faster than their eyes could follow. Many people, in fact, didn't realise that the lollybird even existed. If they praised the work and Luke said, "Oh, it's partly the lollybird's doing too, you know," they believed that he was joking and laughed politely. So, by and by, he gave up mentioning the lollybird. One morning the lollybird said, "Master, it's spring. The cuckoos have come back to the forest and the swallows are here, and the storks are building their houses, and the wild geese keep flying past, and I need to go out and stretch my wings." "Rubbish," said Luke. "You have quite enough healthy exercise flying up and down inside the loom. And we are 2 days late for the set of flags for the new Mandolian Republic. Hurry up and get to work." The lolly bird got to work, but it was sulking dreadfully as it flew back and forth with the red, black and yellow silk threads of the Mandolin flags. Indeed, it clutched some of the threads so tightly in its hot little angry claws, although they didn't snap immediately, the very first time the flags were flown in a hurricane, and hurricanes are very common in Mandolia, several of them tore in half. Now, this was the first time that the lolly bird had ever done bad work. At the end of the day, it felt guilty and miserable and sulkier than ever. That evening, a group of admirers called in to sit around Luke and look at the work half finished on the loom and to praise it. They bought a bottle of wine and presently they all began drinking and singing songs. "Don't you keep a bird in here?" said one of them presently. "Wouldn't the bird sing us a song?" "Oh," said Luke carelessly, "it'll be asleep by now, and in any case it's only a working bird, not a songbird. Its song's no better than a frog croaking." Now the lolly bird hadn't been asleep. The voices and talk and laughter kept it awake, and at those words of Luke's its heart swelled inside it with shame. One of the visitors had left the door open a crack, and under the cover of the noise and singing, which had started up again, the lolly bird crept to the end of the loom, and then flew swiftly and silently out through a crack of the door, although it was black and dark in the forest and only night creatures were awake. The lolly bird had never been out at night. It wasn't accustomed to flying in the dark, and it bumped into several trees. Soon it was lost. Nevertheless, it flew on, listening to the songs of the nightingales and envying their voices. Presently, it reached a wide open space. This was an airstrip, for now Luke had his blue shellfish flown in by plane, and there was the freight plane sitting in the middle of the space. "What an enormous bird," thought the lolly bird, which hadn't had a chance to fly that way since the plane began coming. Just then, the lolly bird itself nearly came to a sudden end, for a large horned owl, which had noticed it bumping among the trees and followed it out of curiosity, swooped down to grab this clumsy stranger and missed it by no more than a flutter of a feather. The lolly bird saw two great golden eyes coming faster than a train and nipped out of the way with a skillful twist learned from years of flying up and down the inside of the loop. The owl thumped against the plane's wing and the terrified lolly bird flew straight through an open hatchway into the plane itself. "Hoo-ha!" shouted the owl outside. "I can see you, you miserable little beggar. I'm going to eat you up in one mouthful. Come out of there!" In fact, he couldn't see the lolly bird at all, and presently he gave up and flew off in search of other prey. But the lolly bird didn't know he'd gone and lay trembling in the dark corner for a long time. After a while, the pilot arrived, climbed in, slammed the door and started the engine. Now the lolly bird was even more frightened, but what could it do? Nothing at all. The plane took off, circled around, climbed higher, flew and flew through the black hours of night until there were many, many thousands of miles from the airstrip and the forest and Luke's little hut. At last morning came, and the sun rose and the plane landed and the pilot opened the door and got down and walked away. Then, at last, the lolly bird dared to creep stiffly out of its hiding place and scramble through the hatchway into the noise and light and muddle of the great airport. There we'll leave the lolly bird struggling in the airport. And if you want to find out what happened to him, tune in next week. You've been listening to us. First part of a story from the book The Faithless Lolly Bird by Joan Aitken, published by Doubleday. If you'd like to hear more of this story, tune in again next week. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC FM at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Our programme is coordinated by Ronnie Noyi. The executive producer is Carly Tinella, and I'm Brenda Phillips. The people. And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Brenda Phillips. Today I'll be reading the second part of the story, The Faithless Lollybird, by Joan Aiken. Last week, you heard that the Lollybird had become so busy working for Luke that he flew off upset and angry. He was attacked by an owl and lay trembling in the dark corner of the plane. The plane took off, circled around, climbed higher, flew through the black hours of night until there were many, many thousands of miles from the airstrip and the forest and Luke's little hut. At last morning came, the sun rose and the plane landed and the pilot opened the door and got down and walked away. Then, at last, the Lollybird dared to creep stiffly out of its hiding place and scramble through the hatchway into the noise and light and muddle of the great airport. There were so many things to see that it saw nothing at all. By pure luck it escaped being run over by a truck or squashed flat by a crane or squeezed in a pair of automatic doors. Avoiding a Boeing 707 and a fire engine and a limousine, it darted between two taxis and flew straight into an open doorway of a bus, which immediately started up and sped off along the wide straight road that led into the middle of London. "My goodness," thought the Lollybird, hanging upside down by one claw from the luggage rack and gazing out with astonishment at all the houses and supermarkets and cats and dogs and people whizzing by. "To think that there was all this in the world and I never knew it." In Piccadilly Circus, the bus came to a stop. By this time, dusk was falling and nobody noticed the Lollybird, which flew out and perched on a windowsill, where it looked at the dazzling lights of the advertisements and many-coloured cars and people in their gay clothes, and the stalls selling apples and pears and strawberries, and the brightly lit windows of the restaurants, and the police cars and ambulances with their flashing blue beacons, and the fire engines all red and gold rushing along ringing their bells. "My goodness," thought the Lollybird again. "I wish Luke could see this. If we had our loom here, what a picture we could make." And then it remembered how angry it was with Luke. "Anyway, I can manage without him," it thought. "All I have to do is string a web from these prongs." The Lollybird began to bustle about, collecting threads and strands of which there were plenty to be found in the untidy streets. First it drew out a long streamer of the smoke trailing from a car's exhaust pipe and wound it into a spiral. Then it snatched a string from a boy's balloon and twitched a length of raffia from a woman's shopping basket. Here it tweaked a dangling end of wool from a girl's shawl. There it snatched a spare hair from a man's beard. All these and many other things were threaded with wonderful skill between the TV antennas that sprouted from the roofs. Now the Lollybird really began to enjoy itself. It picked up coloured ribbons and bits of tissue paper, metal foil, orange peel, tufts of fur from poodles, silvery rings from Coke cans and long shining strands from the tails of police horses. Everything was woven into a huge and sparkling canopy, which presently dangled all over the top of Piccadilly Circus like a beautiful tent. "Oh, what a clever Lollybird I am!" cried the Lollybird with great enthusiasm, and it flew off to do the same thing somewhere else. But meanwhile, poor Luke was in a dreadful state without his Lollybird. He had just managed to finish the job they had been working on when the Lollybird left home, but he found that he was quite unable to start anything else. He had no idea how to set about it. His fingers were too clumsy, he kept dropping the shuttle, his patterns got into a muddle, and in less than 2 days the inside of his hut was one complete tangle of wool, so that nobody could so much as get through the door. At first Luke was very angry at the Lollybird's disappearance. He went stamping through the forest, bawling and shouting, "Lollybird! Hey, you, Lollybird! Where are you? Come back at once!" But there was no answer. All night he called and called. "Where are you, you naughty Lollybird? Where are you, you faithless Lollybird?" But there was still no answer. By this time, most of the people who had come with orders for more work or to watch and wonder at the weaving had become impatient and gone back home again. The forest was empty and silent, but somebody, just as he left, reported that somebody else had been told that yet another person thought he had heard tell that someone else had seen the Lollybird climb into a plane and fly off in it. "In that case, the Lollybird may be anywhere in the world," thought Luke. "How shall I ever find it again? But it's no use staying here, that's certain." So Luke shut up his hut and climbed into the last shellfish plane and flew to London. When he reached London, one of the first things he heard was the story of a wonderful bird that had spread a sparkling web all over the top of Piccadilly Circus. "Oh, that must be my Lollybird," cried Luke, and he leapt into a taxi and told the driver to go as fast as possible to Piccadilly. Luckily, Luke had plenty of money. All these years he had never spent a hundredth part of what he and the Lollybird earned between them. When he reached Piccadilly Circus, he looked about for a beautiful canopy, but it was gone. The Westminster City Council Cleansing Department had come with brooms and mops and vacuum cleaners and swept it down and tidied it all away. But now Luke heard stories about a wonderful bird that had spun a cover like a huge egg cosy, only bigger, all glittering and rainbow-coloured, over the dome of St. Peter's Church in Rome. "That must be my wandering Lollybird," he cried, and he took another plane and flew to Rome. But when he got to St. Peter's, he found that Rome's city council had sent helicopters with mops and hoses and had removed the wonderful cover. "Oh," cried Luke sorrowfully, where shall I find my wayward Lollybird?" But now he heard tales of a marvellous bird that was weaving a multicoloured canopy over the elephant house in the Berlin Zoo. He sent a telegram, "Please, please, do not stop the bird," and jumped into another plane and flew to Berlin. When he reached the Berlin Zoo, everybody was watching in admiration as the tiny bird flew darting about, snatching a hank of wool from a llama, catching a plume from the tail of an ostrich, gathering a tuft of black fur from a gorilla, whisking up a dropped peacock's feather and a bright scale that some fish had cast off, and weaving them all into its beautiful sparkling web, while a whole ring of elephants stood underneath and gazed at it, spellbound with uplifted trunks. "Oh," cried Luke in rapture, "it is, it must be my faithless Lollybird." And the Lollybird heard his voice among all the other voices in the crowd and answered him, "Yes, I am your faithless Lollybird. Come back, you naughty, thoughtless Lollybird. You know I can't manage without you." "No," said the Lollybird, "you can't manage without me, but I can manage very well without you. Goodbye, I'm off to London again." And it flew tauntingly away with a flip of its tail. Come back, you disobedient Lollybird. Goodbye, you can't manage without me, but I can manage very well without you. Poor Luke had to follow as best he could. There was no plane going to London just then, so he caught a boat. When it came chugging up the Thames, he saw that the naughty Lollybird had woven a glittering web across Tower Bridge, all made of straw, wine bottle cases, and scraps of polystyrene, and bus tickets and milk bottle caps. But when Luke stepped off the boat just too late, the vagrant Lollybird flew gaily away, crying, "You can't manage without me, but I can manage very well without you. Come back to your proper work, you wicked Lollybird. Not yet, maybe never at all. Not till you've called me 100 times. Not till you've found a blue dye in the forest. Not till I can sing as well as the nightingales. Not till you promise never to overwork me ever, ever again." "I promise now," cried the sorrowful Luke. "Promises cost nothing. You'll have to prove you're telling the truth before I believe you," replied the uncaring Lollybird, and away it flew. Luke didn't know what to do. He rented a room with a telephone. He rang up the police. He put advertisements in the papers saying, "Lost, my faithless lollybird, large reward to finder." Many people had seen the elusive lollybird and phoned to say so. But wherever it had been seen, by the time Luke arrived, the bird was always gone. Luke wandered through the streets of London day and night, calling and crying, "Where are you, you mockbird?" Then Luke began to hear that the bird had been seen at concerts and at musical instrument shops and at schools where pupils were taught singing. One night, Luke went to a concert in the Royal Festival Hall. Sure enough, there was the lollybird perched on the conductor's rostrum, listening hard to the music. After a while, though, it couldn't resist beginning to flit about and pick up things here and there. A gold thread from a lady's evening cape, a white hair from the conductor's head, a fern frond out of a pot of growing plants, a tie from a flute player's neck, a length of spaghetti from a plate in the restaurant. Then it began to weave a web from the bows of the violinist to the boxes on the opposite side of the hall. The violinists couldn't play with their bows tied down. The music came to a stop, and Luke cried out, "Oh, you shocking lollybird! You are behaving very badly. Come back to your master." "Not yet, not yet. I'm having too good a time to come home," replied the teasing lollybird, and away it flew through a window and across the Thames into a great hotel where it tied all the table napkins into a fluttering string and knotted them around the chandelier. Then it flew all the way down the river, snatching up strings of streetlights and trailing them in the water behind it. Luke was tired out and went back to his room to bed. But by now the provoking lollybird had learned how to use the telephone. Luke had no sooner gone off to sleep than the phone rang, and when he picked up the receiver, he heard a shrill voice calling in his ear, "Hello, hello, hello, this is your faithless lollybird. Come back home, come back and do your proper work." "Not till you've called me 100 times," replied the wayward lollybird, and sang a shrill snippet of a tune. Night after night the lollybird woke Luke in this way, until he grew pale and thin, and had great black circles under his eyes from want of sleep. "Come back, come back, you heartless lollybird," he cried into the phone. "Not yet, not for a long time yet." The lollybird was taking singing lessons from a famous opera singer. In exchange for the lessons, it was weaving her a beautiful cloak from brown paper and string and bits of tinsel and pine needles and photographer's flash bulbs. The lollybird wove its web, and the singer sang scales, and the lollybird repeated them. Its voice was growing louder and sweeter with every lesson, and at the end of each lesson, it would borrow the singer's telephone to ring up Luke and call, "Hello, hello, hello, this is your faithless lollybird. Come home and do your proper work." "Not yet," replied the tantalising bird, and it sang Luke a snatch of music from the magic flute and plunked down the receiver. Now, by chance, Luke heard tell of a famous echo in a cave in a valley in Derbyshire, an echo that would repeat the same word for half an hour at a time, throwing it from one side of the valley to the other. So he took a train and a bus and a taxi to the cave. The lollybird was piqued and inquisitive at being left behind, and it flew after Luke secretly to see what he was up to, and perched on a bush outside the entrance to the cave. "Lollybird," cried Luke inside the tunnel, "come back, come back, come back to your proper work, you teasing lollybird." 100 times he called it, and each word was repeated by the echo 100 times, so that the whole valley was filled with Luke's voice calling, "Come back, come back, come back." "Well, well, perhaps I will some day," said the lollybird, darting about the valley, listening to all the echoes and cocking its head on one side to count them. "But not just yet, not just yet, my dear master." And away it flew. "Not just yet, not just yet, not just yet," repeated the echoes in the valley, as Luke came out of the cave and saw the lollybird, a tiny speck flying farther and farther away over the distant hills. After this, Luke became very discouraged. He began to feel that he might grow into an old man before the runaway lollybird decided to come back, that he might as well give up hope of trying to persuade it. So, very sadly, he went back to the airport and took a plane. He had to charter one specially, for no planes flew that way anymore, and took the last of his money and returned to the forest. The hut was dark and cold, half fallen down, and it was still full of a dreadful tangle of knotted wool and yarn and silk and cotton. Luke was too tired to do anything about the tangle that night, and he had no oil for his lamp, so he lay down in the dark in the middle of it all and went to sleep. But next day, he slowly and clumsily set about the disagreeable task of unknotting all the knots and unsnarling all the snarls, winding up all the different lengths of wool and silk, and setting the hut to rights. But when he had finished, it was still empty and cold and silent. The people who had once come to see him weave had left long before. The railway was closed down, and the grass grew along the tracks. No planes flew that way any more. Winter was coming, and the birds were quiet in the forest. Luke walked slowly through the trees. The silence lay thick as mist. He remembered how the lolly bird had used to fly out with him, looking for plants and mosses. "Oh," he cried sadly, "oh, how very much I miss you, my dearest lolly bird." He remembered how helpful the lolly bird had always been and how cheerful, how much it enjoyed inventing new patterns and finding new bits of stuff to weave with, how lively it worked in the mornings, how willingly it worked long hours, and how much, when work was done, it had liked to sing its little grating song and pick out a tune on the strings of the mandolin. "I'm sorry I was unkind about his voice," he thought. Then he remembered the lolly bird's declaration that it would never return till Luke had found a blue dye in the forest. "But even if I did find one, how would it ever know?" he thought as he wandered along the forest path. Tears ran from his face and fell among the withered leaves beside the path. At last it grew too cold to stay outside any longer, and he went back to the hut. But, to his astonishment, he saw a light shining in the window. And when he went in, there was his lolly bird. It had lit the lamp and kindled a little fire and set a saucepan full of millet porridge on the hob. It was looking at the empty loom and the stacked-up shuttles and skeins of wool and yarn very disapprovingly, with its head on one side. "Am I dreaming?" said Luke. "Are you a dream? Are you really my lolly bird come back at last?" "No, I'm not a dream," said the lolly bird, giving the porridge a stir. "Oh, my dear friend, my long-lost lolly bird, how very, very glad I am to see you." "It's plain I've come back none too soon," said the lolly bird tartly, "for you don't appear to have done a stroke of work since I left home. We'd best have our supper quickly and go to bed, for we'll need to get started early in the morning." Luke was too happy to ask any questions that night, but next morning, when he'd started work, the lolly bird was flashing to and fro across the loom with a strand of rose-pink wool in its beak and another under its wing. He did venture to ask timidly, "I thought you said you wouldn't come back till I found a blue dye in the forest. Why did you change your mind?" "Oh, well," said the lolly bird, looking down its beak with a casual air, "if I waited for that, I'd probably have to wait a mighty long time. And to tell the truth, I was getting a little bored with flying round the world." All day they worked, weaving a curtain that was rose-coloured and black and blue and olive green. When it was done, Luke took a thoughtful look at it and said, "I reckon that's the best bit of work we ever did, my dear lolly bird." And the lolly bird, also after a careful scrutiny and tweaking all the strands with its beak to make sure that none were loose, replied, "No, I don't see anything wrong with that little job, master. Whom did we make it for?" "I really forget," said Luke, "but I dare say it'll come in handy for something. Now, how about a bit of music?" He fetched out his old flute and played a tune, and because of its lessons, the lolly bird was able to sing him arias from the greatest operas in a voice that any nightingale might have envied. Never again did Luke make his lolly bird work too hard or too long. They took no more orders than would keep them busy for a reasonable part of the day, and when work was over, they would go off into the forest, looking for feathers and bright stones, shining petals and gaily coloured leaves. Next spring, to Luke's astonishment, a new flower came up under the trees, a flower that he had never seen before, which, when picked and dried and powdered, gave them a most beautiful blue dye, a blue as dark and clear as the middle of the ocean on a fine winter day. "I wonder where those seeds can have come from," said Luke. "Maybe some bird dropped them as it flew over. What a mysterious thing." But the lolly bird knew that the flowers had sprung from Luke's tears as he wandered sadly along the forest path, crying, "Oh, how very much I miss you, my dearest lolly bird." You've been listening to a story from the book The Faithless Lolly Bird by Joan Aitken, published by Doubleday. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC FM at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Our programme is coordinated by Ron Inouye. The executive producer is Carla Tonella, and I'm Brenda Phillips.
The top of 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 the top of